Hi, I'm Kirsty Cullen, CEO at the Optimum Health Clinic, and welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference to add to our discussions on the importance of both gastrointestinal health and sleep. Today, I am joined by Dr. Gayatri Chudasama. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me. It's a privilege to be here.
Our pleasure. So to introduce, after suffering her own health issues, Dr. Gayatri turned to functional medicine as a way to regain her own health. She has now gone on to support hundreds of individuals across a whole spectrum of health challenges, including women's health issues, male health, digestive issues, diabetes, autoimmunity, fatigue, and more. Dr. Gayatri holds an array of professional memberships, including the Institute for Functional Medicine, the General Medical Council, the British Medical Association, and the Royal College of General Practitioners. And she combines her 11 years of experience as a GP with extensive training and experience using the functional medicine approach. So I would love to begin just there, actually, to discuss really what brought you to a functional medicine approach as a bolt-on to your own more conventional medical qualifications and training.
Yeah, sure. So I qualified as a medical doctor, and I had been practicing for a good sort of 8-9 years, actually. I had done my training for becoming a general practitioner, so I was a GP, and I'd been practicing general practice. And then I was very enthusiastic about medicine altogether when I first started, and I think most doctors are. I mean, you know, we have a passion to help care for people, and I think that's why we all go into this profession, really. But as I was practicing in general practice, I started to get a little frustrated, actually, I think, because I sort of realized that there was a lot of lifestyle things that I was aware of that could help patients. But often we didn't really emphasize on that. And medical training almost teaches us to sort of diagnose somebody with a condition. And then we have a set pattern on how we treat that particular person with whatever illness they have. And I just started to recognize that actually a lot of these patients were coming again and again. So I would give them a medication and then they'd come back because their symptoms weren't improving. So I'd increase that medication or I'd add another medication to that. And then sometimes we were sort of almost treating side effects of medications. Then there's that added time constraint of the 10-minute appointment, which doesn't help the situation as well. And, you know, often I just felt like I wasn't giving a holistic approach to that particular patient, really. So I was looking for different avenues and different ways on how I could combine that. And I wanted to include lifestyle holistic medicine with my medical training, but I didn't know how to do it. I had no idea where I go to or what I do, how that could work. And so ultimately, eventually, I was at a conference for doctors, and I was talking to a colleague there, and I said, you know, it'd be really good if we could include all this lifestyle holistic medicine into normal medicine. And she said, that already exists. It's called functional medicine. and she goes, it's very big in the USA. It's not so big in England. And that was it, really. That was really it for me. I started doing my research. I was so thrilled to find that actually it was validated by research. So many doctors worldwide were actually practicing it. And I thought, right, this is it. This is what I need to be doing. So a month later, I jumped on a plane to go to Chicago, start my training. Literally, so October 7, 2017 is when I was at this conference. November 2017, I was at the conference. and pretty much the year after, I started practicing functional medicine and saw amazing results pretty quickly, much more and much more quicker than I had seen in my conventional practice. So it just kind of spurred me on, and yeah, I just carried on, really. And now I do both. I do both. I do think there is a place for acute conventional medicine as well. I still practice as a GP, but I also recognize that a lot of our chronic kind of conditions probably need a bit more time and a bit more of a holistic approach. And that's where I practice the functional medicine side.
Absolutely superb. And obviously, for those that don't know, functional medicine is obviously a systems biology based approach, isn't it, that focuses on identifying and addressing root causes.
Yeah, root cause, exactly. Yeah. So we're always, and I guess that's the slight difference in the way that we practice conventional and functional medicine. Like conventional medicine is a lot about symptoms and treating the symptoms and helping those symptoms, suppressing those symptoms. Whereas with functional medicine, we're always trying to look for what that underlying imbalance is, what's going on underneath, and how can we actually address that rather than just treating the depression or the diarrhea, the constipation, whatever it is that we're treating. We're sort of looking for why it's happening and we want to address that.
I mean, certainly here at OHC, we follow a functional medicine sort of style approach, which really considers how those functional systems interplay to sort of underpin chronic illness. And I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that healthcare can be quite disjointed. So, I mean, does your dual specialism and the successes you've obviously seen in your own clinic confirm in your mind the need for joint thinking and partnership as a health paradigm moving forwards?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think it is very much happening already, but I think as time goes on, there will be more and more medical doctors, conventional doctors, that will probably see. I think a lot of them know already, really, but it's just fitting it into the system, fitting it into the time constraints and fitting it into the system. That's I think, the bigger issue. But yes, I think, you know, I think as the years go on, more and more people will realise the importance of the dual nature, as you're saying.
I know my clients will certainly laugh at this point because I'm renowned for overrunning, even sort of in a 45 minute consultation.
Oh, yeah.
You quite often find me on the phone still sort of 60 minutes later.
Yeah, my initial consultations are 90 minutes. They don't always last that long.
Absolutely right. But there's lots to discuss always, isn't there? So it's good.
And it's interesting, I think, like for patients as well, what they find interesting is that we really go down to everything that's happened with them since they were born. Nobody's probably ever looked at their health like that. You know, nobody's probably ever looked at what their birth history was like and what kind of things happened through their childhood and, you know, things that they're not even aware of that they then start putting two and two together that, oh, I went through that and I did see a rise in all my symptoms at that point. So it is quite in-depth, really, isn't it? And I think that's almost the therapeutic journey for the patient itself, really.
Yeah, and I think there's nothing more rewarding clinically than seeing those light bulb moments, as you say, where you kind of join the dots for somebody back to a life event from which point health sort of started to deteriorate. So it's very rewarding.
When will you last well? Now, that's our key question, isn't it?
Absolutely right.
When did you last feel well?
So let's dive into sort of some of the elements we wanted to talk about today specifically. So. Sure. Two of the symptoms we commonly see within certainly our ME/CFS population are both gastrointestinal, digestive and IBS related complaints, and then also insomnia or sleep issues. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's true to say that actually we commonly see medications prescribed around those complaints within our patient group. If we dive into considering some of the root causes behind those issues, do you see a functional connection between gastrointestinal health and poor sleep patterns? And if so, what is the relationship between gastrointestinal health and sleep?
Yeah, I think previously there was a lot of research that sort of showed us that sleep or poor sleep caused gastrointestinal sort of problems, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, IBS, those sorts of things. But now we're looking at it the other way around as well, isn't it? So what came first? Was it the poor sleep that caused the gastrointestinal disturbances, or was it the gastrointestinal disturbances that caused the sleep sort of disorders, isn't it? So I guess the first thing is when somebody has poor sleep, then sleep is of course the time when we rest and we recuperate and we replenish ourselves. And one of the systems that would also be affected would be the digestive system as well, right? So the digestive system in the day, you know, your body is wanting glucose, it's constantly breaking down all the food particles to produce the energy that your body needs. And so it's constantly working. So at nighttime, at sleep time, that's the only time that it gets to rest that system. But then when that person has poor sleep, then of course that doesn't happen, which then would often lead to that particular patient having problems in the day because they can't break down the nutrients properly. So then they're going to get bloating, they're going to get constipation, they're going to get all of those other issues. And then that leads to other problems, really, isn't it? Because then if you've got constipation, then your bad bacteria starts to sort of build up in the system, then that causes more issues. That's one of the ways. I guess the other way is hormones as well. So the hormones are affected when you sleep, or when you sleep badly. Anyway, so when you sleep badly, then your satiety hormone leptin is going to get suppressed, and your hunger hormone ghrelin is actually boosted almost. So you have a double whammy for the next day, where you crave all these sugary foods because you haven't got something to suppress your appetite, and you've also got one that's saying that you're incredibly hungry. So I think those are probably the two key sort of things. But we know also that it affects the diversity in the gut as well. So poor sleep then means that there aren't enough bacteria in the gut. And now we know there's a lot of research to show that the more diverse your bacteria is in the gut, then the more your better overall health. So I think there's probably the key sort of relationships between the two.
Yeah, so there was some great research, wasn't there, that specific, I think, bacterial species, so Bacteroidetes, for those that are interested, and Firmicutes have a positive impact on sleep efficiency and sort of sleep time generally. And conversely, a dysbiotic gut or an imbalanced sort of gut bacteria in other studies sort of showed more sleep fragmentation and shorter sleep duration. So actually, it's really interesting for us, isn't it? Because it makes us question how we might be able to support improvements in sleep through manipulation of that gut microbiome.
Yeah, and of course then those who do have IBD or IBS and those symptoms, there's research to show that those patients are probably more in the REM sleep, which is of course the not so restful sleep, which then adds to the problem really, you know, for the next day, because then poor sleep, it's the same issues again. And it's like a vicious circle, really.
Yeah, it's that kind of perpetuating cycle. And as you sort of say, sleep loss can drive sort of the overgrowth of less helpful bacteria, and then those unhelpful bacteria ironically can then produce sort of byproducts or LPS, which might then contribute to fatigue. So it's kind of that chicken and egg situation, isn't it? We're not quite sure where it started, how it started potentially, but we know the cycle that it perpetuates.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting also you mentioned there sort of IBS, because there is a possible link between inflammation and sleep disturbance suggested in some research. So a suggestion that sleep disturbance might in some cases be associated with increased levels of inflammatory markers, so things like CRP and interleukin-6. And of course, I think it's recently actually in this last year in 2021, there were some studies to show that some of the inflammatory bowel conditions might also be associated with increases in those same inflammatory markers. Yeah. So again, it kind of links the two, doesn't it, where inflammation is the central role.
Yeah, and that's actually probably, again, hormone with the cortisol and stress and things like that as well, isn't it? So again, if you don't sleep well, then you've got a lot of the cortisol stress hormone. And this stress hormone, you know, IBD and IBS patients would know about it and they don't like it really. And again, stress would cause what we call leaky gut, intestinal permeability, that side of things as well, which then of course means that particles that shouldn't get into the system do get into the system, and then they start causing inflammation. Then inflammation, you know, it's related to so many different things really. I mean, I think most patients that probably come to us have some degree of inflammation going on. Now, whether that inflammation is in the brain, whether it's in their joints, whether it's in their gut, there is inflammation going on, which is one of the key things that we're always trying to address really, isn't it?
Absolutely right. And of course, central to the function of the parasympathetic nervous system and obviously the ability to both rest and digest is the vagus nerve.
Yes. So
how much consideration should we be giving to the health of the vagal nerve, where there's a clinical picture that kind of includes both sleep and gastrointestinal health issues? Is that something that you consider in the clinic, sort of how to work with calming and sort of parasympathetic nervous system support?
Yeah, I mean, in general, you know, I'm always saying to patients that, you know, that our bodies are designed to actually be, you know, 90% of the time or a lot of percent of the time in the parasympathetic system and only now and again jump into the sympathetic system. But the way that our lives are and the way how busy our lives are and everything that we do, we're actually gone the other way around, where we're constantly in the sympathetic. And actually, we have to actively make the effort to get into our parasympathetic system. And then hopefully, as you do that more and more, then you're in that 90% of the time and less so the sympathetic. So I mean, you know, stress management is a key sort of root of our functional medicine tree. And yes, I do think it's very important. I am always telling all my patients to include some form of relaxation, but active relaxation into their everyday sort of life. So whether in, and it's whatever works for them really. So If they like breathing exercises, they do breathing exercises. If they like listening to music and going for walks, it's that. If they like meditation, if they like yoga, whatever it is, but just something that they enjoy doing and will do every day.
So what are some of the key digestive issues you see in your clinic? As practitioners, we find ourselves talking about the bowel every day, but obviously it's not always a comfortable discussion for some people. So within sort of your particular patient group, what would you say are some of those key digestive symptoms that people might look out for?
That come to me for, did you say?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I see really quite a wide range of patients. I do see a lot of IBD, so Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis patients who are, a lot of them are already on immunosuppressant medications, but they're not getting better with that. And their general health is kind of declining. And so they're looking for kind of alternative approaches. And I also see a lot of IBS as well, because again, I think in the conventional world, you know, after they've treated with, you know, either something to help with the diarrhea, like loperamide, or something to help with the constipation, there's nothing more that can actually be done. So, and actually all of these patients, their quality of life is really affected, you know, they can't travel to places because they're constantly thinking where the bathroom is and things like that. So, you know, whatever it is, their quality of life is affected between those. And I think those are probably the ones that I see the most. And then, of course, as we mentioned before, leaky gut or intestinal permeability, that's, although nobody actually comes and says, I've got leaky gut, I see a wide range of patients with all sorts of different kind of illnesses, actually, who probably have some degree of leaky gut. So I probably see that as well.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not always localized to the gut, is it?
No.
As you say, where there's a picture of inflammation, that may well present in many other different inflammatory symptoms, but yeah, we can trace it back to the gut from a functional medicine perspective.
Yeah, because we obviously hold the gut as central. And, you know, now I'm not surprised at all. Initially, when I started, you did find it odd. I found it strange that, you know, somebody with brain fog or somebody has got sort of, you know, concentration problems, thinking problems, can be anything to do with the gut, really? Like, you know, again, in medical sort of training, we probably wouldn't have put that connection together. Or even people with autoimmune conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, thyroid, all of that side. You know, I never would have seen the connection between the gut and those other things. But now when somebody comes, I know almost immediately that there probably is something going on in the gut. And there usually is, because they do have symptoms 99% of the time. And then, you know, we help resolve those issues. And, you know, some of their other issues seem to disappear, which is brilliant.
So on that subject then, how do you work with people to bring more balance to the digestive system? And what are the kind of the key fundamental tools that you might suggest from a functional medicine perspective?
Yeah, I think it depends where they are actually on their journey. A lot of my patients have already done a lot of research themselves. They've been on various different kind of diets already. So it's then sort of meeting them as to where they are. Some of them also haven't at all. They've never really looked at their diet. They've never been told to look at their diet. Or they've been to the doctors and asked them, what can I do about my diet? And the doctor said, not very much, you know, or the usual sort of five a day or that kind of advice is what they've been given. So I think I do always look for simple things first, really. So just ensuring that they are having lots of phytonutrient foods in the diet. So not the five a day, we're talking 9 to 13 portions a day, which is often a shock, isn't it, to a lot of people. Then I do talk about in that balance of having 4 to 1, so 4 vegetables to 1 fruit, because of course we don't want to upset the sugar sort of balance. Water intake, very important, of course, because again, if you are not having enough water, then you're not going to be opening your bowels as well, and then that leads to constipation and all the problems we talked about before. Making sure that they have protein with every single sort of meal. So those are probably some of the simple kind of things that I would start off with. And then we start delving a bit deeper, really. So are they willing to sort of take out foods from their diet? So what we call an elimination food plan, taking out foods that we know are common inflammatory triggers, and they may not have been, you know, putting 2 and 2 together, but if you take it out for a prolonged period of time, and then add it, you know, you see the connection. So they want to remove that. So there's that. There's simple tests. Of course, I do like to test because I don't want to guess. So if they are harboring a parasite or, you know, some sort of, you know, a lot of bad kind of bacteria or SIBO or something like that, then I want to know about it and I want to treat it accordingly and appropriately. Common things like probiotics, prebiotics to help the beneficial bacteria, digestive enzymes, again, to help with the breakdown. So yeah, I think those are probably some of the common more things that I do to help with the gut.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So insomnia, let's just sort of shift focus slightly for a moment. Sure. Insomnia is such a common symptom. So patterns of restlessness, difficulty in falling asleep or remaining asleep are often seen alongside obviously the classic ME/CFS hallmark symptom of unrefreshing sleep. And it raises the question, doesn't it, over whether circadian rhythm might be regulated slightly differently in ME/CFS patients. So I'm curious as to what your experiences are clinically of sleep disorders or just sleep issues as part of the CFS picture.
I think it's always there. I think there is always some degree of sleep issue going on. With ME and fibromyalgia and that kind of patient. And sleep is such a complex kind of subject because there are so many things that affect it and very easily affected as well. And with somebody with CFS and ME, they've usually, sleep is also causing the problem and also part of the problem, really. So yeah, I think it's a huge part.
And I mean, what are some of the key principles that you might consider to support sleep? Because as you say, the root causes can be so very different, can't they?
Yeah. I think circadian rhythm, sorry, you mentioned circadian rhythm and I missed that part altogether. The circadian rhythm is often not regulated, isn't it, in these patients. And because they feel so tired, they're sleeping at all sorts of times in the day, which doesn't then further help the circadian rhythm, which of course we know is our 24-hour biological clock. So I think getting that into balance is really key. So many patients sort of either try to catch up with sleep on weekends or sleep in later, which then means they sleep later that day. And it's all over the place, which then means our body doesn't know when it's meant to be secreting the cortisol, which is the waking hormone, and then the sleeping hormone, which is melatonin. So I always say to them that, you know, find a time that works for you. You probably know, because when you're at your best, you normally sleep at a certain time and wake up at a certain time. And they probably know that but it doesn't stay that way. And I say, you know, try and wake up and sleep half an hour within that time. That doesn't matter if it's the weekdays, doesn't matter if it's the weekend. If you've had a really bad night, you'll have one day which is really bad, but then hopefully things will get better, because your body is designed to fall asleep. When you're super tired, you will fall asleep. But then when you've got pockets of sleep added here and there, then of course your body's confused. So yeah, that's one of the key things that I do always say.
And I think particularly now our bodies are even more confused by light exposure, aren't they? Because we're designed to have a surge in melatonin when it's dark, and we're designed to have a surge in cortisol as sort of the morning daylight hits our eyelids. And obviously in this current world, we are surrounded by light from screens, we're surrounded just by environmental light all of the time. So actually managing that light exposure can be a really important part of establishing a good sleep pattern, can't it?
Yeah, I agree. So the research actually is that you avoid all blue light emitting screens for almost 3 hours before bed. And I often say this to patients, and I say, I think it's a little bit impossible in this day and age really, but at least if you can do an hour or an hour and a half where there is absolutely no screens, then that's going to have a huge positive impact on your sleep. You know, there is obviously the blue light filter glasses and things like that, but I tend to recommend that actually just avoid screens altogether. You know, I say form a routine that you like doing, a routine that you do every single day, a winding down routine. You know, for busy mums and busy people working a lot, it's often their only time actually that they have as their me time. So I'm often saying, you know, do some yoga, read from a paperback book, do some meditation, do some breathing, have a bath, have a shower, but just a routine of doing some particular thing that you do every day, so that ultimately, again, your body starts recognizing, your mind starts recognizing that it's time to wind down, time to sleep.
And those patterns can be so important to that whole cortisol melatonin balance, can't they? Because obviously if we're busy watching something, that's very bright on TV and it's very stimulating, it's very tense, or it's very exciting, then we've got a body system essentially that just is not prepared for sleep. So
you're stimulated, aren't you? And then when you're trying to consolidate the memories through the night, you're consolidating whatever you've just watched on TV or whatever you, the news that you've just heard before going to bed.
And obviously, from a sort of a dual approach perspective, sort of with the medical sort of side of your training, obviously you're able to suggest melatonin, aren't you? How helpful do you find that sort of as a standalone approach in regulating sleep patterns?
I don't do melatonin very much, so probably don't do that. Yeah, because the problem is with the conventional side, it's not licensed.
Okay, I should pop that out. It's so interesting because obviously we're not allowed to recommend it, but often we kind of see it there on prescription.
Yeah, and it's everywhere. Like in America, you can like buy it everywhere, but in the supermarket, exactly. But yeah, here it's a tricky thing. And so with GMC and guidance and all that.
So quite often what we see clinically is kind of this about face in terms of sort of what I would call a night owl. So often we'll have somebody who finds their wakeful time during the night and actually might not sleep till kind of 4 o'clock in the morning and then will sleep till noon, but then find themselves sort of during what would be their daytime as feeling very fatigued and tired. And it's not unusual to kind of see that reversal of circadian rhythm within CFS. How would you go about sort of gently trying to alter that? Would you sort of move that slowly back to more of a traditional rhythm, or would you sort of move to sort of switch that process quite quickly?
I tried to move it as quick as I could, but it really depends on that person's lifestyle, really. You know, if it's just because they are going to feel terrible for at least a couple of days, they're going to feel awful, and it's going to take time for that body to regulate. So it depends on what their lifestyle is and whether it's okay for them to not feel 100% their best for those 2-3 days. If that's not possible, then I would suggest gradually. So sort of shifting it by 2-3 hours until it is a traditional kind of the traditional night and morning sort of thing.
And another key question that we always get is that I need to nap during the day. I find it really important. Do you want me to cut those naps out to try and establish a better circadian rhythm? Or because I'm fatigued, is it better to rest and have those naps? What would you say to that?
So I often say it's better to nap than to spoil the rhythm that we were just talking about in the morning and the evening. So if it means that they get up at, I don't know, 6 or 7, but have only had 3 to 4 hours of sleep, I would suggest to have a nap, but not make it longer than 30 minutes or so in the afternoon as a better way to sort of handle that fatigue rather than the sleeping in the morning.
And just to sort of round this topic off, if you could give kind of 3 top tips, I suppose, around really securing a better approach to sleep, what do you think those would be? What are those simple tips?
Well, one of them I think I've already mentioned, which is having that routine before bed. That's sort of something I always say quite key, really. The caffeine is another big one, actually, because a lot of patients don't realise, you know, a lot of them will say to me that I don't drink coffee after 6 o'clock in the evening. And I think to myself, that's probably still not having an impact, you know, because obviously we know the half-life of caffeine is between sort of 5-6 hours, which means that even one that you have in the morning is going to be in your system. You know, if we do your genetics and we actually check how you metabolize caffeine, that could be longer. Caffeine is a big one, caffeine tea intake or stimulant kind of drinks and things like that as well. So I normally recommend no more than 2 cups and no later than 10 a.m. in the morning. That's probably one of my other ones. Regulating the rhythm to having the same sort of pattern for morning and evening, that's probably, and the screens, I think limiting all those screens is probably another one. What else? Mornings, I think getting outside and getting the morning daylight, again, because of that circadian rhythm. So even if it means that you have your morning coffee outside in the garden or something like that, then that's probably better than exposure to the brightest light inside. I think those are a few key things.
I agree. You'll often find my clients sat with a blanket sort of right in front of a big window or sort of on the patio. I'm also a big fan of the sunrise lamps, particularly sort of through the
month. Yes. So that's another good one as well. Yeah, especially in the winter months when you've got seasonal affective disorder kinds of things, which is affected so much by light. So yes, that is another thing that I would suggest as well, that, you know, whatever their natural sleeping time is, if they have one of those lights that comes on gradually, that's probably better for their waking up.
Fantastic. That has been so informative, Dr. Gayatri. So thank you so much for joining us. Now let's just direct people who want to find out a little bit more about your work, where would they need to look?
They can go online and just look at my website. The website is www.drgayatri, which is drgayetri.co.uk. They can go there. They can find all the information that they possibly need.
Wonderful. Many thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you ever so much for having me.